Hello, and welcome to The Truth is So Boring, your bi-weekly radio program about stuff that's going on.
Stuff that happened already.
Yes, stuff that happened.
But sometimes about upcoming things, too.
My name is Scott. My pronouns are he, him.
My name is Owen. My pronouns also he and him.
And we have a number of topics for you today, I think five or six. To start off, Owen had a quick headline he wanted to throw in, a John Deere picketer at the ongoing strike at the John Deere factory was struck by a vehicle.
Awful, says at Jamieson on Twitter. It appears a driver struck and killed a picketer on the line at the John Deere facility in Milan, Illinois? IL is Illinois, right?
Mm-hmm.
Early this morning. This was a couple of days ago now. In 2019, a UAW striker was also killed on the picket line at a GM plant in Tennessee. Now, I might be the only person who holds this opinion, but, like, every time I see stuff like this, I just go, what is it with fascists and vehicular manslaughter? Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that scabs are fascists, although some people might hold opinions to the contrary.
Yeah, I don't know. I personally think it's more of a in-the-moment kind of thing, but there is certainly a trend there, now that you mention it. Anything further to say on that?
No, it's abhorrent, and people should try to be safer around pickets and respect them and not drive into them.
Yeah.
Like, this is an intimidation tactic that has been used before, and I need to come out with, like, a whole show on this.
Yeah, I remember seeing, there wasn't anyone hit and killed, but there was some UAW workers who were, like driven at earlier this year at a strike, which just...
Which, yeah, I mean, because in 2019, a UAW striker was hit by a car, that looks pretty clearly like an intimidation tactic to me. I could be wrong, though. I love that song.
Yeah, you do. Our next story today is comes to us from what was it again? Unionbulletin.com. Just something I saw as I was browsing around the internet this past week or so. A federally endangered bumblebee, the rusty-patched bumblebee, not pictured on the screen.
That's it is pictured on the screen.
Oh, that's the same kind?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Why would I pick a picture of someone that... Okay.
I thought you just grabbed a picture of a bee.
No. Okay, listen. If you're tuned in at MTC Cable Channel 20, or if you have access to that channel, I am currently running a slideshow. You can see a beautiful bumblebee, the rusty patched one, on a wild bergamot, Monarda fistulosa flower, which I planted some for my grandma this year, so I thought it was kind of nice.
Yeah, and they are really nice flowers.
And they're really nice bees, too.
Anyway.
They're indigenous to around here. By the way.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, their territory includes here.
The rusty-patched bumblebee?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll get into why that might not be so soothing about this particular topic in a moment. A federally endangered bumblebee, the rusty-patched bumblebee, has temporarily saved one of Illinois' rarest prairies from the bulldozer, but only until November 1st. That's in, like, 5 days.
Meanwhile, biologists and conservationists are working to convince the prairie's owner, the Chicago-Rockford International Airport, to change its plans for a roughly 280-acre expansion that would go through the heart of the Bell Bowl Prairie in Winnebago County. Hang on just a second. I have a picture of the prairie.
This five acre virgin gravel prairie, so that's pretty small, is part of only 18.4 acres of this type of prairie left in the state. Wow, that's very small.
Yeah.
According to the Illinois Natural Areas Inventory.
Oops. There we go. There's a picture of the prairie. Again, if you're tuned into MTC Cable Channel 20,
yes,
it's a beautiful place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it is.
Bell Bowl Prairie contains at least 164 species of plants, many of which are rare, and birders have found rare nesting birds such as the grasshopper sparrow there, too. Quote, it's like having a 500-year-old ancient grandfather clock and saying, I'm going to tear it up and throw it in the fireplace so I can roast marshmallows, said Randy Nybor, a recently retired ecologist with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and Illinois National History Survey, or Natural History Survey, excuse me.
I would argue it's actually even more tragic than that, but it's a good metaphor.
Yeah, I would say so, too.
Airport officials would only comment in an email about the expansion plans. The airport, quote, followed all guidelines and rules set forth by the FAA, federal, state, and local government that are required in order to proceed with any development in the assessment area. This included public notices, public meetings, and notices to all media in the area. As required, RFD, the airport, completed the environmental assessment in 2019 and ultimately received a finding of no significant impact from the FAA in November of 2019.
Okay, the FAA is not an environmental org. The FAA is the Federal Administration of Aviation, right?
Mm-hmm. But they are the, I think they are the relevant body.
Not the EPA?
Right. Yeah.
What the heck?
I mean,
so there's something that's clearly off, yeah, like about this whole process.
Anyway, that quote was from Zach Oakley, the Deputy Director of Operations and Planning for the airport.
Oh, I've been cleared by the industry. That's like the police investigating themselves and finding them to be at no fault. Like,
which that, does this happen. Isn't,
yeah, happens all too often. And does not count, in my opinion, as a real inquiry.
Endangered species laws say that the habitat needs to be protected when a rare organism is on the property. But once it leaves, the habitat can be disturbed. Some biologists, and myself, consider that to be a major flaw in endangered species protection laws. And attorneys general in 17 states filed a lawsuit in 2019 after the Trump administration further gutted the Endangered Species Act.
Okay, lots and lots of things migrate, and I'll get into the biology of this bee. It doesn't stay in the same place at every stage in its life, and I can easily see how, like, this rule could be used to not intentionally
disrupt migratory patterns.
Yeah, not intentionally necessarily. Like, I'm not saying, oh, it's they want to go out and destroy the bee, but, like, that's what is going to materially happen if you destroy land that things that periodically use the land.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like what happened with the enclosure of the prairies and the, you know, the roaming bison is, you know, they weren't able to roam anymore and they died off.
Yep.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, queen bees hibernate underground in the winter and emerge in the spring to lay eggs that produce new queens, males, and workers. The old queen, males, and workers die before the end of the season. New queens, already laden with eggs, then burrow a few inches beneath the soil to hibernate. Disturb the prairie soil, and any new queen bees that decided to hibernate there may not survive to reproduce.
It's like bulldozing the bumblebee, Niobeer said.
Go on.
No one knows for sure, however, if any queen bees are currently hibernating in Bell Bowl Prairie, and endangered species laws don't address that issue, which you would have to go and disturb a bunch of, like, prairie in order to find out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Like, you'd have to go digging.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, it's their natural habitat for hibernating, so it would kind of seem obvious.
Yeah, it would stand to reason that they should be there.
Although you could take a minor sample area and not disturb the whole environment. But still, I generally am against what is it, Paving Paradise to put up a parking lot.
Yeah. Ah, we should have had that song today. Oh, well.
It's too catchy. I don't like to hear it.
That's fair.
It's good lyrics, though. Anyway, the rusty patched bumblebee has declined by 87% in the past 20 years and is likely present in 0.1% of its historical range, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
So while we do live in its territory, there probably aren't any here in the Catskills. They're mostly down in Illinois.
Hmm. While technically not illegal to, quote,
bulldoze... This is Illinois, right?
Yes, actually. That's interesting that there are two stories about Illinois.
Yeah, it's the Illinois episode.
Weird coincidence. While technically not illegal to bulldoze the bumblebees, as they say, the government does have some leverage over the airport.
The airport received at least $44 million in governmental funding, with a $9 million federal grant in 2019 sanctioned by U.S. Senators Dick Durbin and Tammy Duxworth. The Land Institute is staging a letter-writing and Facebook campaign called Save Belle Bowl Prairie, asking politicians who have earmarked money in the past for the airport to intercede. Now, some notes on the bee itself, like I promised. Bomba affinis, which is the natural...
Oh, here you go.
requires three different types of habitats, each for foraging, nesting, and hibernating, which are geographically close, but...
Isn't this for the next slide?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well, the next slide is just a picture of the bees. I think it's taking a while to respond. My apologies. But, can I just continue?
Yes, please. I'm sorry.
So this bee requires three different types of habitats, each for foraging, nesting, and hibernating, which are geographically close to and distinct from one another, making the species particularly vulnerable to extinction, especially by, you know, paving paradise again. It requires a temperate climate and can even withstand cold temperatures that most species of bees cannot. Members actively forage between April and October, thus requiring flowers to bloom for a long period of time. Little information is known of their hibernation habitat, but they most likely live underground or burrow into rotting logs during the winter to survive. This is from Wikipedia. Mm. I would trust the environmental experts who weighed in earlier in this article over Wikipedia, but this is a pretty decent overview. Until the 1980s, it was one of the most common species of bumblebee in southern Ontario, Canada.
Hmm.
I wonder what happened.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder. Gee. Mm-hmm. Our next story comes from the rather interesting and ubiquitous Unusual Whales article.
Unusual Whales is an organization.
Unusual Whales blog, I mean.
Yeah, well, okay, not much of an I don't know if I should call them an organization. I think it might just be one person, but they run a blog.
They refer to themselves in the plural, but they could be just be using the royal we. I think there are multiple people working together on that project.
It's a project of open data... to make data on contributions to like campaigns and
no actually they're focused on exposing insider trading.
Oh, well, they
have a subsection called "I Am the Senate" on congressional trading records and comparing those trends to the effects of laws that have been signed and lobbying efforts.
Yeah, I mean, the point is to make that dateable, accessible, and easy to digest for the average person who doesn't have time to learn data science or to go diving in the records of these things.
Well, actually, it's not that hard of data science in this regard.
Yeah, but, like, the average person shouldn't have to know data science, you know?
It's actually pretty simple to get this data. It's just very time-consuming, so yeah. I appreciate him doing it. But I did actually dig into some of the data on this. Actually, to something totally unrelated. I was just talking to somebody about something unrelated, and it's pretty easy to look up. You just go. I just googled congressional financial disclosure reports, and it takes you to a site where you can search by last name and
open
state
secrets
and district. No, it's a government website.
Oh, word! Although Open Secrets is also good.
So basically, people go to this government website and they one at a time go through and download all these reports, and they have to, you know, they're in PDF format, so you have to read them manually. You can't just parse them with a script or something like that. And so, yeah, that's the sort of reporting that we're talking about here. And I mean, like I said, it's not hard to do. It's just something that I really appreciate these guys taking the time to summarize a bit,
because most people don't have time to do that.
So, to quote Unusual Whales, for literally months now, the White House has been negotiating with Senate Republicans and centrist Senate Democrat Joe Manchin on what constitutes infrastructure and who should pay for it. Republicans, led by Senator Shelley M. Capito, were adamant that taxpayers, like you and I, should pay to maintain traditional infrastructure, like roads, bridges, and broadband. And there's some interesting notes on the broadband that we'll come to later.
I do have a graph up on, again, if you have access to MTC Cable Channel 20, that gives a breakdown of Biden, Capito, and the final deal, which actually has been since revised as of yesterday, so there's even less than the final figures here, and I made a note, we'll get to that in a minute, but if you want to just take a look at the breakdown, it's there on TV for you. We'll have this stuff posted online, too, in our notes, as usual, of course.
Yeah, we always post all of our notes and our graphs online at thetruthissoboring.org.
I just took the graph from this article and I made it a little bit easier to understand, that's all.
Along with the episode itself, the afternoon after airing. To continue with the quote, meanwhile, Biden and Senate Democrats had a larger definition of infrastructure that included things like school construction, repair, and even home and elderly care. They argued that corporations and the rich, people making more than $400,000 a year, should pay for it.
Okay, I'm sorry, but this is only like barely related, but this reminds me of like the recent Twitter drama that discourse around whether or not making $100,000 a year makes you rich, which...
It depends on where you live.
No, it does.
Very much so.
It makes you rich.
Well, no, it very much depends on where you live, because the cost of living, like,
yeah,
inflation varies across by the country, like regionally. It's not.
Yeah, but there are still people making like 35 grand in those areas too, and they still have to get by somehow. So, that's the discourse in a nutshell.
Anyway, Biden's more extensive plan was for $2 trillion. And Republicans countered that with $928 billion. Now, I would like put a very big pin in these numbers. These trillions of dollars numbers are over a 10-year period.
Yeah.
So we're looking at $200 billion a year, or...
like $75 billion?
Yeah. Which is...
much smaller than a trillion.
Well, I mean, that's...
It's a lot less than we spend on our military.
Exactly.
That's like the cost of one military contract.
And by framing it as a 10-year number and not saying over 10 years, it makes it seem a lot more outsized and a lot more spendy than it actually is.
Yeah.
The Republicans, to go back to the quote, they stripped away funding for green initiatives and social infrastructure.
Go figure.
Focusing solely on roads, bridges, waterways, broadband, etc. Biden had been vocal about his willingness to reduce his plan by more than $1 trillion, but guaranteed funding for clean energy and new jobs, or required guaranteed funding for clean energy and new jobs. The counteroffer appeared unable to meet those demands, and ultimately negotiations with Senator Capito broke down. I don't know if I really have time to get into this, but reading this saying... they stripped away funding for green initiatives, focusing solely on roads, bridges, waterways, pipelines, and fossil fuel subsidies are considered infrastructure, but green energy production is not considered infrastructure.
What?
That bothers me a lot.
Me too.
And as we'll get into in, I think it's in the clip that we're going to listen to. If not, it's in the most recent Congressional Dish episode. The green energy initiatives that are getting put through are often carbon intensive, so mm-hmm. burn fossil fuels anyway, or are very focused on hydrogen fuel cell technology, which is something that hasn't really been...
No, it's a thing.
It's a thing, but it's not been widely looked into for like 15 years. We've been focusing on solar and wind because those are more viable.
It's hard to get people on board with hydrogen cells because they think it's more dangerous than just regular fuel because they're like, oh, I don't want to sit on an explosion, which...
You are.
That's what a regular car is. What do you think internal combustion means?
It means it lights itself on fire thousands of times a second.
Yeah. Anyway, so, no, we've had hydrogen fuel cells. It's like nuclear energy. It's hard to get people on board because of the associations with
it. Well, but by focusing on this thing that you know has a problem with marketing, that you know has a problem with, like, convincing people to adopt it, is inherently going to make your green initiatives look ineffective and...
Yeah.
A waste of money and time, which, you know...
One could say it's arguably intentional.
Yeah, one could argue that. I don't think... I don't think we are. So right now.
No, me neither. But there's, like, there's a real ratchet effect here that, like, you can see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you put forth ineffective green initiatives, and then people who don't want green initiatives say, look how ineffective the green initiatives are, and then the green initiatives get rolled back.
And then we don't have any.
And then the planet burns. Anyway, a bipartisan deal was struck by leaving Senator Capito out of the conversation and making a series of compromises. No increase to the gas tax or EV user fees in order to pay for these new investments. No increases to corporate taxes either. Taxes will be raised on individuals making over $400,000 a year. And IRS enforcement will be beefed up to make sure those making $400,000 a year pay more. Mm-hmm.
You know what I really don't like about this plan? Because I don't see... Well, okay, first of all, in the graph that we got, the green initiatives just aren't included at all, like, as a figure.
Yeah, well, I do want to point out that this graphic that we're looking at does only pertain to a subset of the topics which are getting funded, so...
Yeah, and I had to knock one off of the one that we have up on the screen for anyone who's on Cable Channel 20 as well, because... It was twice as high as anything else on the graph and would have made it completely unreadable. That was a home and community-based care. Biden proposed $400 billions.
Or $40 billion a year.
Capito wanted zero, and the deal ended up at zero.
Same with the $10 billion a year for school construction and repair.
Now, what I think is really ridiculous is like that electric vehicles at all are just so heavily focused on. And specifically, you know that when they say EVs, they mean cars, not, like, public transit.
That's a separate category.
Well, public transit is its own category, but, like, an electric bus is an electric vehicle, but, like, I'm sure that not a single electric bus is going to be bought with the $15 billion that's going into it. Biden wanted $174 billion for electric. Are you kidding me? Does this have something to do with the fact that all of Congress is investing in Tesla right now?
I wonder.
We'll get to that in a minute.
This brings up that we should do at least a segment on the unsustainable Ponzi scheme of car dependent suburbs sometime.
Unsustainable. Yes.
Strong towns, not just bikes, do great videos on that. It's a really interesting and kind of scary problem.
Once more, for those in the back, YouTube, Strong Towns, interesting series on urban infrastructure as well as suburban road infrastructure. You get to learn some cool new words like strode.
For a more entertaining version of that, you could watch Not Just Bikes. They do content on Strong Towns. Strong Towns itself is like a legal organization, and their content's kind of dry.
That's fair. Not Just Bikes is a bit more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so getting into the weeds a bit on these congressional trades. A short list of stocks was compiled by Unusual Whales by skimming through the many top X stocks that will benefit from Biden's infrastructure bill articles that have been published in the last couple months. Basically like, hey, you have money to invest and, you know, let's look at where what stocks will matter.
Returns.
Yeah. For the everyday people. This list was used to filter congressional trades made since the Biden first introduced his plan on the campaign trail. I'm sure to reduce the scope of the study because, like I was saying earlier, the data is plentiful and somewhat difficult to go through. Highlights from the House data. Do you want to take this?
I'll start. Representative Susie Lee picked up a CCI. What is CCI?
That is a company, Crown Castle. They, we'll get into that in a minute.
Okay. Susie Lee picked up CCI back in August of 2020, and that's now up 24%. Recently, she picked up Evoque, with a Q, Water Technologies Corporation, AQUA.
I think it's supposed to be Evoqua, like Aqua, but evolved. That's terrible.
That's such a...
I hate marketing.
Yeah. In mid-February, and that's currently up 42%. Wow.
Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz's spouse picked up EMKR. I don't actually think I wrote down what that is, if you know stocks.
No, a relatively unknown mixed signals optical equipment company.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I should have kept reading. It was their only purchase this year. The $45K they invested at $6.28 over a two-day period, three purchases, rallied to $10.34 at peak. She is up 60%.
The broadband company is interesting primarily because it will likely benefit from both versions of the infrastructure bill. A lot of reps and senators play broadband, and these companies will likely benefit from the, quote, Build America initiatives.
On March 17th, Representative William Keating bought a huge swath of stocks in different industries.
You're excused.
Some infrastructure-themed stocks he picked up during that time included CCI, Caterpillar Inc., Jacobs Engineering Group, and United Rentals Inc., all of this before Biden's big announcement on the details for his infrastructure bill. He's up 20% on CCI and 8% on Jacobs Engineering.
I just wanted to make a quick sidebar about municipal broadband, which is almost certainly not going to get any funding from this bill. It's all going to go to friggin' Comcast and Xfinity and crap. What we really need is to provide our own ISPs and infrastructure so that we don't have to pay out the nose anymore.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, I don't think I'm allowed to make policy recommendations on this show, so that's what I personally would like to see happen, but not necessarily WIOX.
I don't think it's unobjective to say that municipal broadband has been shown to
be more cost effective
and provide better service
to more people
in places where it's been allowed to contractually permitted to be implemented.
And there are many states where it is illegal to do this too.
Well, specifically, around here, there was a contract struck between the government and three local small telecom providers, which gave them regional monopolies in the area in order to build out the broadband. And that seems to have gone slightly better than just dumping it all into Xfinity, perhaps because it's more tied to the community and more local. But I also have heard that it's not as cheap or as good as what you might get through municipal broadband. Again, you know, just stuff I've heard.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a show on this at some point.
We should do a segment on municipal broadband.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
I keep programming little blurbs about them, and then we don't have the time for it. So, like, I'm just going to keep saving those until we have a show's worth of material, and then we'll break it all down for y'all.
Cool. In contrast to the mountain of data that was available for
the House,
senators haven't disclosed as many infrastructure-related trades since July 2020. And I just had a note here that everyone seems to be super into Tesla right now, and Owen saw that in the notes and had to make an additional note on Tesla in particular here.
Sidebar on your sidebar. In mid-August, the NHTSA, that is the national... Okay, I forget what... Why don't you expand that for me while
yes.
I keep reading? In mid-August, the NHTSA launched an investigation into 765,000 affected Tesla vehicles with model years from 2014 to 2021. The investigation was launched due to 11 instances of Tesla vehicles crashing into emergency vehicles since 2016. The vehicles were
that's really specific.
Yeah, the vehicles were allegedly operating with autopilot of traffic-aware cruise control.
There's
a couple articles on this in the notes if you want to read more about it. This is just a sidebar.
The NHTSA is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Yeah, so they're in court right now over this.
So just because the senators did not buy as many stocks doesn't mean that there aren't some juicy bits here. Senator Ron Wyden's spouse bought Oshkosh stock just after Biden announced his big climate change proposal on July 20th, 2020. She has held since and is up 67%.
I'm not sure what children's clothes have to do with climate.
That's a good point, but also, that's a big,
Ooh, that's a potential child slavery thing.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. Maybe we should look into that.
we should look into Oshkosh Bagosh before making any more potential statements about
it. But just like getting a return of 67% on a purchase over a year, little over a year, is just nuts.
Yeah, that's more than luck.
In more clear connection here, Senator Shelley Capito's spouse bought American Tower Corporation.
Tower.
I said tower.
Yeah, you did. I just...
a notable wireless infrastructure giant, which I will bring... I'll talk a little bit more about in a second. He is up 18%, and it's interesting to note that Senator Capito's counteroffer did not decrease funding to broadband at all.
Oh, and in case you're not on MTC Cable Channel 20 or able to see our slides... this slide, I would say, is humorous, but it's really not because it's a really horrific crash. Yeah. There's no gore or anything. I'm not going to put gore on the TV. But basically what happened is this Tesla autopilot decided to drive it underneath a semi-truck.
And it sheared off the top of the car at the top of the doors.
Yeah, it's just gone. I don't even know how those taillights are operating.
Worst imaginable way to be decapitated.
to be corporeally removed from this plane of existence.
Yeah.
At least it was probably quick.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
And I mean, I don't know if I've talked about this on The Truth Is So Boring before, but like, I've worked in autonomous robotics.
I know how hard
this problem is. They do not have the hardware to do what they're promising they can do. It's a death trap, and you should never turn on autopilot if you own a Tesla.
I am under NDA for at least another couple of years, but I got to work for Uber ATC for about a week and see some of the inner workings of that. And it was eye-opening.
Relevant to...
Oh, Uber ATC doesn't exist anymore, by the way. They were based in Pittsburgh. They were, like, one of the pilot programs for Uber's autonomous vehicles. And, yeah, the whole building I used to work in is owned by something else now, as far as I remember.
Yeah, I'm not sure if Uber ATC doesn't exist anymore, but at least that branch of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, lobbying activity relevant to the infrastructure bill is also disclosed at both the House and Senate level. How much money flooded into the Senate at the beginning of the year, and could this have affected what sectors were prioritized later during negotiations?
The highest contributions were reported by the broadband sector, CCI, with $1.89 million, and AMT with $1.43 million, followed by energy companies and general infrastructure stocks in construction and metals. This may be why broadband investments didn't budge during negotiations.
I want to state the companies lobbying against certain measures are not being considered here. For example, there are huge lobbying efforts against certain EV credits. These lobbying efforts are indirect and more difficult to quantify, but need to be stated and understood in the changing nature of the bill. Please see numerous legacy oil and gas companies for their lobbying efforts here. And so there's a graph. It's up on the TV and in our show notes at thetruthissoboring.org if you're listening to this in the archives.
This 480p is killing me. I should have remade this. You may or may not be able to actually read this graph on the TV. If you can't, I am sorry.
But since this is an audio format radio program, I pulled out some highlights from the graph and have some comments here. Now, as noted in that paragraph, Crown Castle and its affiliates, an American Tower Corporation...
own the land that the broadband towers exist on.
Yes, and they...
So they collect rent, presumably?
Yeah, they gave a... They lobbied a combined well over $3 million to see funding for broadband because they, again, own the land the towers are on and collect rent from the infrastructure companies. It was interesting to note that Caterpillar is one of the larger lobbying efforts at $1.33 million, and they receive a lot of investment from Congress, a lot of Congress people buying stocks from them, but not a lot of return yet. comparatively to some of these other ones, which are, you know, giving 60%, 40%
just returns. Unheard of returns. People are like, oh, well, that's just the stocks. It's just random luck. No.
I find it difficult to believe. Energy companies were a large portion of this. NextEra Energy is a American energy company with about 58 gigawatts of generating capacity, 24 gigawatts of which are from fossil fuel sources. So a rather large provider of non-fossil fuel energy sources, and they lobbied with $1.21 million.
Hey, remember how we heard on the previous show, the 801 with Kent Garrett, that like something like five plants were responsible for like 70% of global emissions or something like that?
No, I must have missed that.
Either that or it was like 14,000 plants, and then a few of them in particular were really, really bad, and then combined they were responsible for like 70% of emissions. I'm just curious if NextEra Energy owns any of those plants.
Cummins Inc. is an American multinational corporation that designs, manufactures, and distributes engines, filtration, and power generation products. Valero Energy.
They make gas. I mean, you've probably been to the gas stations. My mom likes them.
Yeah. I think they're in... I think they're related to Sheetz as well, although that's not really around here very much. More of a Pennsylvania thing.
We'd have to look into that.
Enbridge Inc. is a multinational pipeline company headquartered in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And all of these organizations lobbied with numbers in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Biden's deal was sacrificed slightly. However, it is still set to pass. Importantly, numerous House members and senators have purchased stock that will directly benefit from this deal.
This is huge. With the incoming infrastructure projects, the benefit from trading these infrastructure stocks cannot be oversold. Politicians are benefiting from these deals, with possible projects to be awarded in these numerous stocks. They purchased before, they are benefiting after.
Have they leveraged both their vote and inside knowledge of these trades due to lobbying? Perhaps. CCI is one of the largest lobbying powers, and incidentally, numerous House members purchased its stock. What do they know that the average person does not? The argument has been made that congressional members should not have any financial stakes in the success or failure of specific companies, private or public, especially before a bill. The question should always be, how can public good be best served unbiasedly? And on this topic, I have a clip for you.
So they reintroduced it in this Congress, and it's the For the People Act in the House and the Senate. It's H.R. 1 and Senate 1. And the bill numbers are significant here because that's the order that basically, like, the number one bill that you want to pass is your one. So the fact that it's H.R. 1 and Senate 1, the Democrats are like, this is our number one priority. This is what we're going to do. And yet, what are we hearing about? Infrastructure and reconciliation. But they do have this going on kind of like on the side, and the media is not paying that much attention. So what's happening is the For the People Act is getting hacked away at. In fact, it's got a new name. So the next iteration of it, the hacked one, is going to be the Freedom to Vote Act. So that's what they're making out of the bones of the For the People Act. Now, let's just take a beat to remember why this is so necessary right now. Like, one of the provisions that was in the original bill and that would remain in the hacked version, the Freedom to Vote Act, you know, like the one that makes it basically harder to rig elections by drawing your own districts. This is super important this year and for this upcoming election because we just had the census last year. So the reason that we do this whole redistricting process is that we have this census, which counts where everybody is in the United States. And that means because the House of Representatives districts are determined based on population, as the population changes, so do the districts. So some states lose representation, some gain representation, and they redraw the maps. Well, the Republicans in 2010 did a very smart, evil thing where they organized to win as many state elections as they could in 2010 so that they could rig the maps. And they've done it again. And so the Democrats do rig the maps too, but just the way that the Republicans are like, they called it Project Red Map, for Christ's sake. Like, they had a name for it, they had a goal, and they were quite effective in doing it.
That's so, the difference is the Republicans are good at this.
They're excellent cheaters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the Democrats, like, they're trying to play the Republicans' dirty game, but they're just, like, bad at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Although you can't say that because they did also write the For the People Act. So it's like they are trying to do the good thing, or at least some of them are, because this is another one of those situations where the Democrats are their own worst enemy. So, but basically, like, one of the problems that we're having right now and why this is critical right now is that the Republicans are expected to gerrymander a net gain of about 20 House seats.
God damn.
I know. They're so good at it. And so what this bill would do, and it depends on which version you're looking at, the For the People Act or the Freedom to Vote Act, but it would ban partisan gerrymander by basically having either computer models or independent commissions draw the maps. Now, I'm sure that there's pros and cons to either of those, but it's definitely better than letting political parties draw the map because they won, you know, the state's legislature, however it's done at the state level. Like, that's where the problem is. So just having this national, like, no, this is how we do it, and it's not like Republicans go ahead and draw your districts and circle the voters that you want or don't want. Like, that's the process we currently have, and it would kill that. So this is really, really important right now, and it is being gutted again behind closed doors. This isn't happening in committee where we can get sound clips and watch the debate. Like, nope, it's behind closed doors. And the person that is gutting it most effectively is once again Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. And thanks to David Moore, an incredible journalist writing for probably one of my favorite, definitely one of my favorite publications at this point. It might be my actual favorite, but he's writing for Sledge. He found out exactly what Joe Manchin is doing to this bill. So here are some of the ethics reforms that Manchin is making sure are not in the bill. So Joe Manchin wants to get rid of the provision that would ban U.S. representatives from serving on private company boards. Now, one of the reasons for this could be that Joe Manchin listed a handful of private positions on his financial disclosure report in 2020. Here are some of them.
So wait, so he sits on the board of private companies while he's serving?
As a U.S. senator.
That's ridiculous. How is that? How is that even allowed?
Exactly. I think that's how most people would feel about this.
That'd be like having a referee in the game who's like, oh, I also play for the Lakers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is. Yes. So Joe Manchin is a partner in MPM Properties, which owns real estate. He's also a partner in Manchin Enterprises, which is another property management company. He's also a member in the company AA Property, but no one really knows what that is or if he's making any money. But the real scandal is that he's earning money while a senator from his family's coal brokerage company, Energy Systems, where he owns stock worth up to $5 million. And he also has up to $500,000 in something called Farmington Resources, also involved in fossil fuels. By the way, in the last episode about the fossil fuel fire known as the bipartisan infrastructure framework, I told you about a provision that would install quote-unquote clean energy projects on former mine land, which isn't really clean because 3 out of the 5 projects are allowed to burn fossil fuels with carbon capture, but whatever. But Joe Manchin's family company, Energy Systems...
Carbon capture doesn't work.
The ones that he has $5 million in...
Carbon capture does work, it just doesn't work as well as it needs to in order for us to use it effectively to combat climate change, which the IPCC says we have to do if we want to have any hope of mitigating anything above 1.5 degrees Celsius.
You're right. I was hasty. I'm sorry. Also, I'm pretty sure 3 degrees C is locked in.
It's 1.5 C that's locked in.
Oh, okay.
Stock in?
3 is likely.
That's poised to directly profit from that provision, which he personally fought to get included into the bill. And they would profit because his company has a contract with the only company that can process the waste that would have to be removed from those sites before the new projects could be built on the reclaimed mine land. Like, what? But to your question, this kind of overt corruption is possible because according to the Senate rules, senators aren't allowed to be, quote, officers or members of the board of any publicly held or publicly regulated corporation, unquote. But privately held or nonprofit corporations, they can be on the board of those as long as they don't receive compensation. Now, Joe Manchin's company is privately held by his family and is operated by his son. And technically, because he doesn't draw a salary from the company, this is all cool because he gets paid in stock.
Ooh,
And then he writes the laws, and the profits go up, and his stock goes up.
Stocks, capital gains tax is a lot lower than income tax. Is not a stock capital gains?
Yeah, but not only that, more salient to the point is, you know, he writes the laws, the profits go up, and the stocks go up. It's income, even though he's not allowed to make income, technically. You know, it's just a way of shuffling the numbers. Anyway, I have a very short story that I really want to burn through real quick. Before that, she mentioned something about gerrymandering, and I didn't have time to put this in, but I noticed this morning that Governor Hochul made gerrymandering illegal in New York, which is...
Yes!
New York employers cannot test for cannabis use. New York employers are no longer allowed to drug test most workers for marijuana, the Department of Labor announced a new guidance.
While many legal cannabis states have made it so workers can't be penalized for testing positive, New York appears to be the first to explicitly bar employers from testing for THC at all, with limited exceptions for certain categories of workers. Employers can still punish people for being actively impaired on the job, but the new rules create a high threshold for proving impairment, going so far as to say that the odor of cannabis is not enough on its own to be used as evidence.
Nice.
Yes, because it really isn't. I mean, like, tomatoes smell like pot. I remember... go on.
In essence, New York's DOL said in a FAQ, Frequently Asked Questions document published earlier this month, that drug testing requirements for marijuana constitute discrimination.
Can an employer test for cannabis?
No, unless an employer is permitted to do so pursuant to the provisions of Labor Law Section 201-D, (4-A), or other applicable laws.
Can an employer drug test an employee if federal law allows for drug testing?
No, an employer cannot test an employee for cannabis merely because it is allowed or not prohibited under federal law.
Awesome.
Since there is no device that can test for active impairment, mm-hmm. and tests for THC metabolites can show traces of marijuana for weeks after a person consumes marijuana, the employer must show that a given worker manifests specific, articulable symptoms of impairment in order to punish them over on-duty marijuana use. These symptoms must decrease or lessen the performance of their duties or tasks, and interfere with an employer's obligation to provide a safe and healthy workplace free from recognized hazard, as required by state and federal occupational safety and health laws.
The Department of Labor said, observable signs of use that do not indicate impairment on their own cannot be cited as an articulable symptom of impairment. So if they see you smoking, that's not a symptom of impairment. So mm-hmm. they can't just be like, oh, I saw you smoking a joint. I'm going to fire you for that. Although, to be fair, we're not right to work, are we?
I have no idea.
Dang, I should have checked that.
Also, like, right to work is a different thing. You're thinking of at-will employment.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, oh, yeah, you're right, at-will. Well, I'm just saying, like, there's always that out in places that are like that, to just fire someone for no reason instead of a reason. But the fact is, like, this is taking away
I'm sorry.
Go on.
I really want to get this part of the conversation out. The whole framing of cannabis use, this is me talking. I wrote this in our notes. The whole framing of cannabis use specifically and drug use in general seems wholly disconnected from the reality of the origins of these policies. Liberals and conservatives alike hand-wring about safety and impairment upon repealing the oppressive policies thoroughly summed up in this short quote from John Ehrlichman, counsel and assistant to President Nixon for domestic affairs. You know the one.
The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. As quoted in Legalize It All, Harper's Magazine, April 2016.
This seems oddly prescient, considering yesterday, the 27th of October, was the 51st anniversary of the Nixon administration passing the Comprehensive Drug Abuse Prevention and Control Act as a part of their war on drugs. A Nixon advisor later admitted it was based on a lie to disrupt left-wing and black power movements.
The Comprehensive Drug Abuse Protection and Control Act of 1970...
I actually don't want to read the whole quote here. It's the thing that invented the schedules. You know what the schedules are. You know that Schedule 1 is the government saying we get to decide through legal policy what is medically acceptable as opposed to doctors being able to decide for their patients. Just the every person who's in prisoner for the drug trades is a political prisoner. And if you think that you live in a free country with millions or at least hundreds of thousands of political prisoners,
I have news for you.
Yeah. Anyway, so that wraps it up for this week's edition of The Truth Is So Boring. Probably going to run about 2 minutes long. Sorry, Jim.
But please stay tuned for Jim Router. He plays great music every week.
It's good music. You can find the show at thetruthissoboring.org. My name is Scott. My pronouns are he, him.
You can find me at
dscottboggs on Twitter.
My name is Owen. I like to bulldoze Scott. you can find me at Catamount Commie on Twitter. My pronouns are also he and him.
And you can check out my other podcast, Do Not Learn to Code, at donotlearntocode.org. Past episodes of this can be found at thetruthissoboring.org. And come chill out with me tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. For Cat's Chill. This final clip is it's just a skit from a recent episode of Seriously Wrong. And I hope it makes you think.
And before that, though, I wanted to give a shout out to our one subscriber. We have a subscriber!
Online!
Thanks for joining us. Feel
Mr.
free to interact.
Tuttle.
Who?
Mr. Tuttle is their username online.
Thank you so much for showing interest, Mr. Tuttle, and please, we are happy to interact if you want to.
We now go to a wealthy property owner smashing his own privately owned ventilators with a golf club in front of an overcrowded hospital during the COVID-19 crisis, because that is his legal right.
Okay, that's ventilator number 3. Woo! Okay, now on to 4 and 5.
Hey, what are you doing there? Is that a shipment of ventilators for the hospital?
No. These are my privately owned ventilators. I just bought them
you're
myself.
You're smashing? That's pretty fucked up.
No, I'm allowed to. It's totally okay.
But think of all the people that you're hurting inside. That's like you're hurting them by doing this.
No, there's been a misunderstanding. So under our legal system, property is a relationship of absolute power of an individual like myself, based on how much wealth you have to buy it or obtain it, over an object. Property rights aren't a relationship between people. The relationship is between me and the property. And honestly, you're just some schmuck. You have no say. And nor do the patients or doctors. These are mine, so I'm allowed to just smash them. And I want to.
That doesn't seem right. I mean, I guess, like, yeah, I could break my phone right now if I want. Like, we can break things we own.
Yeah, you
could
just throw it on the pavement, and I invite you to. It's
pretty
fun.
But I don't want to do that because I need my phone, and people need these ventilators. Like, someone put all this work into building these. People are dying.
I put work into earning money to buy ventilators to smash in front of a hospital during COVID.
Yeah, but you exist in a society. The idea that you could destroy your property with no regard to how that affects anyone else, it's abusive, I would say.
Abusus.
No, I said abusive.
Abusus is the Roman legal protected right to abuse and destroy your property. Let me just give you a little more context. I think this might help you learn, maybe for the first time, what's going on here. So, according to West Indian sociologist Orlando Patterson, the conception of freedom and property, which is the sort of dominant one in our society today, actually originates in ancient Rome. And it essentially traces back to slave law. So it theorizes that property relationships are an absolute right between an individual and an object. So that includes the right to destroy it, which is called abusus. For example, with slaves, you know, it's a private matter in the home where you can murder, rape, mutilate, whatever you want in ancient Rome. And obviously, you know, slavery has been abolished. And I would never mistreat a slave if slavery was here today, personally. But that's sort of the legal order. It's actually really interesting.
So you're saying that the right Roman to destroy property comes from slave law? This is your argument in favor of what you're doing?
Yeah. So in ancient Rome, the legal authorities of that society, I mean, no matter their sort of ethical content and what they were striving for, in addition to their public lives, they would return home to an extreme sort of private domain of patriarchy and slave ownership, where they had absolute command and control power over their wives, their children, and hundreds of slaves who were considered to not have any rights at all. So those slaves would do things like cut their hair and wash their feet. The origins of slavery in this context were the capturing of enemy soldiers and then bringing them into slavery as people without rights, as property. Although in many cases, you know, the slaves actually were not literally war captives, but they were still treated that way under the legal system. And that was what they were surrounded by. That was what was normal to them. you can trace a direct genealogy from that slave society's conception of property to the current day. In our current society, obviously, slavery has been abolished, and I would never mistreat a slave. I'd never do that. I'm a good person. But when it comes to ventilators...
It makes sense that that's where it came from. Because when you think about it, the idea that you have total control over anything, whether it be a human being or even a tool or an object that we've built in a society together, is kind of ludicrous when you think about it, because, like, you can do this. Like, that's allowed under this system.
I absolutely can.
And you can just think of it like it's a private affair between you and your property, your ventilators.
It
just
is.
But it's clearly not, because there's other people here in the hospital. Look, there's another ambulance showing up, wheeling a person who needs ventilation into the hospital.
Well, you don't know that. Maybe his foot's hurt.
They have one of those handheld things. They're pumping oxygen into his mouth as they run with it. I'm pretty sure.
Maybe he's tired.
I don't even know why you're fighting on this, because if he needs it or not, it doesn't matter to you, right? You just said that. You're going to keep smashing either way.
It's actually really interesting, because it's often theorized that a smaller society can be more egalitarian naturally, and as you scale up, hierarchy sort of naturally occurs. But this is sort of a counterintuitive example of maybe the opposite, because these are cases where slaves that masters had absolute rights over were doing care work in the home, cooking for the family and stuff like that. And same with patriarchal relations in this context, women doing the care work in the household, but then having a patriarchal sort of authority of the household who can command and control them. It's a very hierarchical relationship at a very, very small scale. So it seems like the origins of these sort of hierarchical relationships don't actually come from scaling up, but come from, in some cases, the smallest sort of relationships of all, the household. And that doesn't really justify what I'm doing. More the abuses thing does, but that's just an interesting thing that I learned.
Yeah, that is interesting, that there's this connection between those basic relationships of domination that can form between individuals and the conceptions of domination that we use as the basis of our understanding of how we relate to objects and property. It's that idea that just like you're a sovereign over something else, over other people, over the products mm-hmm. of society, the things that we've built together, because obviously you couldn't just build a ventilator on your own.
Well, you don't know that.
Without a society, I kind of do. Oh, this just makes me think of a future society where everything might be kind of like a library. You know how, like, a library book, you can take it out, but you can't destroy it. You can use it and get benefit from it, but you can't destroy it, you know? Like, because other people are going to use the book later. There's something to that. That's a kind of property relationship that makes more sense to me than this destroying ventilator thing.
Right. Well, I mean, that's why I've got ventilators and you don't. You're a dreamer, and I'm a pragmatist.
Well, I would try to stop you, but then the police would come and arrest me.
Yeah, it's the job of the police to protect my property rights.
So I guess carry on with what you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah, and you have a good day.
I probably won't.
Do you want to take a swing?
This is going to haunt me. No, thank you.
Don't let it haunt you.
Oh, it will. It will.
You're surrounded by stuff like this every day. You got to be desensitized to it by now.
I am, but this is just such a particularly in-my-face example of it. Yeah, it's a rough one. It's hard to ignore this one.
Well, yeah, that is not going to ventilate anything. That is a hard-to-get part there. I'm just going to smash it.
And that was a wealthy property owner exercising his legal rights.